Good afternoon. I would like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 29th. Let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. We have present Representative Gray, myself, Chair Vance, and I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. I would like to take this moment to thank Deputy Attorney General Mr. John Skidmore for providing the donuts for today's committee. So I will give a moment for everyone to be able to enjoy those as we wait for our other members to come from their prior meetings. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames of the Juno LIO. Thank you for your service, and I will take a brief at ease. Back on the record, I would like to let the record reflect that Representative Carpenter and Representative Groh have joined us. We have a quorum to conduct business. The committee will hear House Bill 98, State Ownership of Submerged Lands, by Representative Sadler in its first hearing. So I'd like to invite Representative Sadler and his staff, Ms. Mary Jackson, to the table. Please put your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Well, Madam Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you very much. For the record, this is Dan Sadler, representative for House District 24, and the privilege of being Majority Leader. But more importantly today, I'm the primary sponsor of House Bill 98. I want to introduce my Chief of Staff, Mary Jackson, who will be presenting the sectional analysis. We also have Mr. John Sturgeon of Supreme Court fame, to present a little bit of his story, and members of the Department of Natural Resources Public Access, Assertion and Defense Unit, the POD Unit, who will give us some more detail about what this bill will mean. Madam Chairman, this bill actually tries to seek to have the state fulfill its responsibility in its basically its statehood birthright. We hope to end the federal government's decades-long unjust denial of one of the fundamental benefits of statehood, which is control of the navigable waters in Alaska and, of course, ownership of the lands underneath. Navigable waters are the lakes, rivers, and streams that supported or could have supported travel at the point of statehood through traditional means that were available for use at the point of statehood. These routes provided recreational access, commercial travel, hunting opportunities, aquatic habitat, and more. They represent corridors of commerce for Alaska, which are critical to our sovereignty and our prosperity. All other states assumed undisputed control of their navigable lands and waters at the point of statehood when they joined the Union. A little bit of legal background, the 1959 Alaska Statehood Act transferred 105 million acres of federal land to state ownership. In addition, through action of the U.S. Constitution and other important federal law, which our lawyers will get into, also made this state the owner of navigable waters and the lands underneath them at the instant of statehood. That includes more than a million acres of waters and land underneath, and more than 18,000 miles of rivers in Alaska. Now, despite the federal government's obligation to do so, federal authorities have dragged their heels, imagine that, in granting Alaska clear title to our submerged lands. Instead, they have forced the state to, basically on a case-by-case basis, defend the navigability status of waterways at a rate that would take hundreds of years and untold millions of dollars to conclude. Simply put, enough is enough. House Bill 98 says, we are the owner, we have title to the beds of navigable waters, importantly, including those that underlie waters inside federal conservation units that were created after statehood, and more explicitly, those that were created by the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, 1980. Title to these lands and waters inside federal parks, wildlife refuges, forests, and other conservation units. There is a proviso unless they were specifically withdrawn for federal use before statehood. Those lands we're going to just forget about. It identifies, importantly, and enumerates water bodies within federal areas to which the state has a title interest, and it directs the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner to make progress reports by the first day of each legislature on its continuing efforts to delineate navigable waters in federal areas in Alaska. The need for this bill, Madam Chair, is dramatized by the case of Mr. John Sturgeon, who fought and won two U.S. Supreme Court decisions clarifying that Alaskans indeed have the right to use navigable waters in Alaska inside federal areas, and that federal regulations do not trump state law, even in conservation units created by ANILCA. If you've read through the bill, you might ask yourself a question, is this bill necessary? Is it redundant? It is not redundant. It is complementary. Current state law does assert that the navigable waters are state lands, but this essentially calls on the federal government to en masse to give us a determination to acknowledge our sovereignty. And if they disagree specifically, then it becomes incumbent on them to tell us they're not navigable, so we can pursue that through other means. But right now, this is an important bill for our sovereignty, an important bill for our access for our community and our citizens to the lands and waters that were promised us at the point of statehood. I appreciate your hearing this. I'm going to invite my Chief of Staff, Mary Jackson, to run through the sectional analysis, if I may.
Chair Vance, members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I am staff to Representative Sadler, Majority Leader. The bill is 88 pages long. I point that out to you. I'm sure you've noted it. 84 of which pages, that is, are the descriptions of the lakes and the rivers and not the meat, if you will. It is the meat of the bill, but it is not the verbiage of the bill. So there's 13 sections. It's really pretty straightforward. Section 1 amends the law by adding a new section to describe the purpose of the bill. Section 2, we have a phrasing, at the time becomes on the date of, and that is from legal, from our legal. I can't describe exactly why, but it's more specific. And Section 3, and I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I'll just kind of wait a little bit after the end in the event there's a question on the sections. Section 3 amends it by revising the phrase again at the time to by the date or on the date. And then it also adds language regarding the commissioner, which is basically that we're directing the commissioner to conduct ongoing research as to what are, in fact, navigable lands. Section 4, again, is the at the time to on the date. Section 5 references a list of navigable waters that are further defined later on in this and revises again the time, the phrase at the time to on the date. Section 6 inserts a clause B or C of new sections 3 and 4, bouncing back and forth in the new pieces of the bill. And it operates a disclaimer for determining the navigability by the DNR commissioner, providing they don't create an interest in real property. Section 7 amends by revising the phrase at the time to on the date. Section 8 is new subsections, H through J, that create an obligation by the Department of Natural Resources to report annually to the legislature. Section 9 is the new section with 83 pages of listing of waterways. So this is what the state is claiming. These are ours. And perhaps anticipating a question in this, let me dive into it to begin with. Why is this in statute instead of just being in the DNR in the commissioner's office? And the direct answer is this is law. Assuming this bill passes, the 33 legislature has decreed these our lands. And it's not just a single sole elected executive from the governor. Section 10 is new paragraphs for definitions, renumbers some things, of course, and adds a proposed definition for federal areas. Section 11 repeals an existing section in law, which is the current definitions. Section 10 is new ones. Section 11 repeals old ones. Section 12 amends the uncodified law to give a new section with regards to retroactivity back to January 3rd, 1959. And because of that, the bill will require a 2/3 vote of the members of each body when it goes to the floor. And Section 13 provides for an immediate effective date.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. I'd like to let the record reflect we were joined by Representative Eastman at 106 and Vice Chair Allard at 112.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Dan Sadler for the record. Mr. Sturgeon, John Sturgeon, is available to us by the miracle of teleconferencing. He's not here in person. So with your indulgence, can I ask him to make a presentation on his case and how it jives with and affects influenced by the substance of this bill?
Yes, we do have Mr. Sturgeon online. He is the president of the Safari Club International Alaska chapter. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Sturgeon, and as president of Safari Club Alaska and 750 members, I am testifying in support of House Bill 98. I would like to sincerely thank Chairman Vance and the committee members for listening to my comments today. The state of Alaska is incrementally being cheated out of one of the most cherished and valuable sovereign rights, the right to manage its navigable waters, like every other state. Management of many of its navigable lakes and rivers are being withheld by the federal government. The state of Alaska must take strong and decisive action immediately or watch while it loses management over thousands of miles of rivers and thousands of lakes. Remember that approximately 80% of Alaska towns and villages don't have road access. Their roads are Alaskan rivers. Under the Equal Footing Doctrine, the State of the Act, the Submerged Land Act, the state was granted ownership at statehood of the submerged lands on all navigable waters between ordinary high water marks. The state constitution, statutes, and regulations clearly state the state owns and manages these submerged lands and navigable waters, and the citizens have the free and unrestricted access unless restricted under regulations authorized by the state legislature and not the federal government. There are exceptions, such as Coast Guard boating regulations, but Alaska law could not be clear on what our rights are and our duties as far as navigable waters. Thanks to two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, Sturgeon v. Frost 1 and 2, the court unanimously ruled the state of Alaska has a legal right to manage all navigable waters and lakes and the submerged lands beneath them, regardless of the upland ownership. In that case, the federal government was saying that as these like the Yukon River flowed through the Yukon-Charlie Rivers National Preserve, that because the upland was owned by the federal government, that they could manage the river in that section. The Supreme Court said, no way, no how. That court case took 12 years and $13 million contributed by thousands of my fellow Alaskans. Unfortunately, the federal government has been extremely slow in conveying title to these navigable waters and submerged lands. Only 9% of the state's title in navigable waters have been adjudicated by the federal government. This is in spite of numerous lawsuits by the state of Alaska on navigable waters. The state has not lost even one of these lawsuits. It is clear after these numerous lawsuits, there's emerged a clear definition of what constitutes a navigable water in Alaska. The federal government just chooses to ignore it and keep trying over and over again for a definition of navigable waters that they like. However, even with these court losses, the federal government continues to try to redefine what constitutes a navigable waterway. Either the federal government is intentionally dragging the process out, or they are totally inept, or both. House Bill 98 provides a declaration by the state of Alaska which navigable waters it considered to be owned by the state of Alaska. In essence, it plants the Alaska flag on all these waters for all to know who owns and manages them. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and the committee members, for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon. If you would stay available after the other invited testimony, I have a feeling you may have questions.
Ma'am, I will stand by.
Thank you so much. I'd like to get to the other invited testifiers because I imagine all of them may have a litany of questions. If I would now like to invite Mr. Jim Walker and Danny Havensek, if you would please join us at the table, state your name for the record, and begin your testimony. Brief at ease. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Jim Walker. I am the Section Chief of the Public Access Assertion and Defense section of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, a mouthful. With me is my colleague, Daniel, or Danny Hovancic, who works with me as a team member on the PAD section, which is, again, the Public Access Assertion and Defense section of the division. It is our pleasure to be here in support of House Bill 98. And a brief word, if I may, about what my team does and the comments that we are going to offer in support of this legislation. The PAD unit, as we call it, has two primary missions. One, to assert and defend state ownership, management, and control over navigable waters and submerged lands statewide. That's the first part of the mission. The second part is a similar mission with regards to RS-2477s and other state easements that provide much of our transportation network statewide. So it is with pleasure that we speak here today in favor of House Bill 98. As I go through, I think a few moments to frame the issue of why this is important and why the legislative action is required. So the navigable waters issues, and both Representative Sadler, Mary Jackson, as well as John Sturgeon made reference to this, that throughout the state, there are, by our estimates, 800,000 miles of navigable rivers, and there are 30 million acres of navigable lakes. And pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine of the United States Constitution, the Alaska Statehood Act, and the Federal Submerged Lands Act, the state of Alaska owns the submerged lands below all navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced waters within its boundaries, unless, this is the one exception, there is a valid pre-statehood federal withdrawals. Post-statehood withdrawals do not affect state ownership of the submerged lands. They belong to us, wherever located. So, in coming slides, you are going to see where we analyze particular conservation system units and other federal areas, which is the purview of this bill, to show where exactly the state owns the submerged lands. And the key is, are they navigable in fact or tidally influenced? And you will see that in most federal conservation units statewide, the vast majority of those submerged lands are owned by the state of Alaska. This does not come from our statehood selections pursuant to the Alaska Statehood Act. Rather, this was conveyed to Alaska just like every other state as birthright, the ownership of these submerged lands and navigable waters. And the idea behind that is that through the Equal Footing Doctrine, the federal government, when it welcomed Alaska into the Union, wanted to give it the wherewithal to make it as a state, to have the lands it needed and the transportation corridors that it needed so that it did not become a ward upon the federal government. So if we could, let's look at what this legislation does specifically. Next slide. On the screen in front of you, you will see a variety of federal areas statewide. We have National Park Service areas. We have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service areas. We have U.S. Forest Service and finally Bureau of Land Management areas. Within all of these areas, in the absence of a valid pre-statehood withdrawal, the state owns the submerged lands. So, looking at the first category, the National Park Service units, the Noatak National Preserve, the state owns the submerged lands under navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced waters there. The same with Kobuk. Denali, this is an important illustrative case. With the Denali National Park and Preserve, there was a central nucleus, a core, that was the McKinley Monument. That was a pre-statehood withdrawal that expressly included the submerged lands. The state doesn't own those. But subsequently, building upon that central nucleus, like concentric circles, the park was added to, the preserve was added to. And in all of those areas, those post-statehood additions, the state owns the submerged lands under those navigable impact waters. In the bill that is before you, it's long. It's 83 pages of that is a list in which we are meticulously going through every federal area in the state, my team with the Public Access Assertion and Defense section, and analyzing each of these federal areas to determine what is navigable in fact, what is tidally influenced, and what may be excluded because of a pre-statehood withdrawal. In the bill, that 83-page list consists of all of our work to date on the National Park Service areas, the U.S. Forest Service areas, and one of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service areas, namely the Tetlin Refuge. Our work is continuing, as you will see from the bill, and as Representative Sadler indicated, there is an annual reporting requirement. So if this bill passes, you can expect to see me next session coming before the legislature and saying, we have now finished our work on those remaining U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service areas. Here is the list of navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced waters. Please add that to the list. The following session, I suspect we'll get through the BLM lands. And then there will be ongoing quality assurance and quality control. Specifically, we are in litigation with the federal government on a number of rivers statewide. As those results, you know, as the decisions are made, we will come back to this legislature and say that there needs to be possibly amendments made. For example, as my colleague Danny Hovancic will point out, we were very conservative in our navigability estimates, right? We didn't go as far upstream as we think that it's reasonably navigable. The reason we didn't is this is a public-facing document. The public relies upon this. And we do not want the public to unwittingly find themselves in John Sturgeon's situation, where they are forced to litigate before the United States Supreme Court twice and incur legal fees in the name of the amount of $3 million to vindicate their rights. We wanted to be conservative so that people who relied upon this list would have confidence that what they are saying is going to be backed up by the state of Alaska. Everything in this in the list that's contained within the within this legislation relates to an online map that is on the DNR website, so users can move between the two documents very easily. And all of the numbers, the SWFA, state water federal area numbers that are listed in the bill, relate to files that we have. So a member of the public goes to the map, sees a list, a listed water, can pick up the phone, call our office, and we can give exact details about this. Next slide, please, Danny. As both John and Representative John Sturgeon and Representative Sadler indicated, the acknowledgement of the federal government to date has been disappointing, to say the least. As of right now, from the date of statehood to the present time, the federal government has acknowledged our ownership of only 9% of those 800,000 river miles and only 16% of those 30 million acres of lakes. If we continue at this pace, it's going to take hundreds of years and cost untold amounts of money for the exact limits and definition of what is this state's birthright to be finally and finally determined. This legislation, we believe, is going to be an important impetus to call the question, to force the issue with the federal government. In other words, they, just like the general public, can look at this list. And as they look at this list, if they disagree with us, please tell us that. Because when you do, you have staked a claim. You have stated that you own those submerged lands. And hence, you have put a cloud on our good title. And we have standing to sue you pursuant to the Federal Quiet Title Act to resolve that cloud on our title. By contrast, look at this list. See that we're right. Agree with us. Acknowledge state ownership, and they are beginning to do that, pursuant to the map that we have prepared and actions of our team. Acknowledge state ownership. And so both of us managing our resources, the federal government on the uplands and us on the submerged lands, can work towards the ultimate, which is the public good. Next slide. A large impetus behind this effort and behind a lot of our statehood defense efforts was the case that John Sturgeon brought. And we are fortunate to have heard from him directly and heard his support for this legislation being offered by Representative Sadler as well. With that, if there are any questions so far, I'm happy to take those. Otherwise, I'm going to pass the mic to my colleague, Danny Havancic.
Questions from committee members? Representative Groh.
I'm perhaps not as familiar with acronyms as Representative Carpenter, but can you remind me again what CSU stands for?
Through the chair, Representative Groh. It stands for Conservation System Unit, and it is simply another way to describe federal areas in the state that were specifically created by ANILCA. The Alaska Natural Interest Lands and Conservation Act.
I knew that. Me too.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, it sounds to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the law states that we own the submerged land and these navigable waters. So, you know, in the sponsor statement, there was discussion about federal authorities have forcing the state to prove the navigability of waterways on a case-by-case basis at a rate that would take hundreds of years. Is the federal government waiting for a piece of legislation from the Alaska State House in order to recognize the law as it already is? That's the question. I mean, like, is this bill necessary when we know that the law states that we already own these?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, excellent question. And I see several different questions in there, and if I may, I'll unpack them one at a time. First, regarding the need to litigate these cases, right now, the status quo hurts one group of people, and that is the general public, right? Good land management only follows a clear understanding of who owns what. And right now, the status quo that is characterized by some ambiguity favors the federal government. In place after place throughout the state, the federal government takes the position, maybe it is navigable, maybe it isn't. We haven't decided. And until we say so, we're going to treat it as non-navigable until a court decides. That ambiguity is what hurts the public. And that is the reason, that is the impetus behind this legislation. Let's spell it out, chapter and verse. In all of these federal areas, here is a list with a geographic description. And you can see exactly what we are claiming within these federal areas. Either acknowledge our ownership or tell us we don't. And when you tell us we don't, you better be sure that we are going to serve a 180-day notice on you of our intention to begin quiet title litigation. It calls the question. But the other thing that you asked about, Representative Gray, was the leadership that this particular piece of legislation can provide to the federal government. You asked, are they waiting for the state to claim this? I hope that they are, because this is a bold statement of what we own in these areas. And it is my hope that if this legislation passes, we can work with our congressional delegation to offer federal legislation, companion legislation that incorporates all the work that this legislature has done by reference. That is the goal with all of this.
Follow up.
So,
what I heard you say in the first part is that with these this list of 83 pages of waterways, that the Alaskan public could use that as a reference and could say, well, I'm going to take advantage of this waterway. And if the federal government has a problem, it's not with that individual Alaskan. It's with the state of Alaska for telling the public that that was their waterway.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I feel that it is my team's duty, whenever possible, to get between the federal government and individual citizens. This legislation, whereby the Alaska people are stating through their legislative body by statute, we own this. This is ours. Gives us, to use an expression, skin in the game, so that if someone, in reliance upon our map, in reliance upon this list, chooses to recreate in a manner that is acceptable under state law within these federal areas and is challenged by some federal law enforcement authority, we, the state of Alaska, have standing to involve ourselves in that litigation and to vindicate those rights on behalf of all Alaskans, you know, not just that person, but we can stand up for all Alaskans in doing that.
Follow up. I want to ask a question about part two of your previous answer, which it makes sense to me that we would have an expectation that our federal delegation would need to do some work, since basically, we're asking the federal government to do something. Is that correct?
Through the chair.
To observe the law, basically.
Through the chair, Representative Gray. Sure, we absolutely want them to follow the law. The law that already exists. The law that has been established in cases like John Sturgeon's case, like in cases that our Department of Law, Ron Opsahl, who's on the line, Jesse Alloway, before have filed and won against the federal government. We want them to follow that law. No question about it. In terms of there needing to be any action by the federal government, the Constitution has already done that. The federal Constitution, through the Equal Footing Doctrine, through the Alaska Statehood Act, Congress, and also Congress through the Federal Submerged Lands Act, have already stated this. This just makes it crystal clear, right? It takes an abstract concept that we own all of these submerged lands and gives particular definition to those places where we do.
Thank you.
Before we get too much farther along, I'd like to let the record reflect we were joined by Representative Johnson at 1:23, and I would like to welcome former Senator Scott Ogan to the committee, who helped establish the RS-2477. This happens to be one of his loves, is our statehood defense and access. So if any other members have questions before we continue.
For the record, Daniel Hovancic, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Madam Chairman, members of the committee. The state of Alaska has identified 9 actions to assert our ownership and authority over navigable waters and submerged lands therein. These are the tools of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Team that we use to defend our statehood entitlement of those submerged lands. In federal areas, the rivers are either navigable or they're non-navigable. The current status quo, in which they are undetermined, hurts Alaskans, managers, the public alike. If the federal government deems a river non-navigable and the state disagrees, we can move forward with one of our strongest tools, being quiet title litigation. It's at the top 12 o'clock position of this bubble chart. This allows us a path forward to clear the cloud on our title if it exists in that scenario. If no navigability determination exists, there is another avenue. This is an administrative remedy. In particular, it is the Recordable Disclaimer of Interest Program, in which we can file administrative paperwork, including evidence and our own navigability determination, proving that a certain river is navigable. The federal government could either agree or disagree, but regardless of their choice, we would have standing to challenge them if not. The issue comes when the river remains undetermined. We're hoping that establishing this law in front of this body and codifying the submerged lands beneath navigable waterways would allow us another path forward and another tool that we can use as resource managers within DNR. None of these tools exist in a vacuum. They are all interrelated. They enhance each other and all come together to form our network of statehood defense as it relates to navigability. Simply put, this bill does four things to jostle the status quo and to shake loose the situation we have in front of us. Number one, it codifies State of Alaska ownership, management, control of navigable waters and the submerged lands therein. It makes clear the extent of our authority and the process by which we move to assert that authority. Number two, it specifically lists navigable waterways within these federal conservation system units. In doing so, it makes it abundantly clear and leaves no doubt to what exact waters we are talking about in these particular instances. The individual user or the manager can look to this and understand where state law begins and ends and where federal law begins and ends. Number three is it enshrines foundational elements of relevant case law, drawing that necessary link between the case law that has been established, the law of the land, and our administrative action. It provides justification for our actions as administrators, but it also shows that these navigability determinations that we await from the federal government, these are a matter of law, that these questions have to be settled as a matter of law, and that we are owed a navigability determination so that we have a path to move forward. Number four is it establishes an annual reporting requirement and charges the Department of Natural Resources with ongoing investigations of submerged lands beneath navigable waterways. And it allows for further refinement over time so that when we learn more about these particular waterways, when we learn more about the geographies at hand, we can make the list reflect reality as best that we can. We're going to go through these one at a time and talk in detail about them. Number one, why do we need to codify State of Alaska ownership, management, control over submerged lands? In particular, this is something that Mr. Sturgeon, Mr. Walker have already spoken to, but this is a natural process for a state. Every other state has gained title to the beds and banks beneath their navigable waterways. We have been waiting for this for 64 years, and federal inaction has kept us from gaining title to what is our birthright. In particular, we believe that this will force the question, it'll force some element of a federal response to make them either acquiesce and agree with us or push back against our assertions. So by stating this loudly and by stating this clearly, we are hoping to draw out a federal reaction to what has been silence up until this point. Further, we believe that if this bill does one thing, and one thing very clearly, is it provides an education tool that provides clarity and provides direction to the public. The individual user looking to recreate on a waterway would know to look towards state law if they found it in this particular legislation. Further, a manager who received an application for commercial guide service, per se, would be able to look at this piece of legislation to understand whether their authority to issue a permit exists. The status quo, the way things exist now, is that manager would have to consult with our section. We would undergo a navigability determination on our end and then get back to them, causing administrative lag and administrative hurdles where none need exist. Beyond that, these waterways correlate to publicly maintained records and maps and provide a roadmap for public managers. Another point is that no land conveyance would occur if this bill passed. These are lands that we have owned since January 3rd, 1959. It's not that a transfer of land would come down because of this particular action or this particular bill. But what it does is it accurately reflects land ownership and management on the ground. It removes the ambiguity that exists for managers, for the public, for Alaskans, and it just shouts from the mountaintop where we believe our authority extends in these particular instances. Number two, I will speak directly to the list. This is the vast majority of the bill, as you've likely seen from the packet in front of you. It's roughly 83 pages of the 88 pages therein. The way this list was created was taking five PCNs within the state. These five individuals assessed modern day aerial imagery, historic aerial imagery, modern day use accounts from recreationalists, pack rafters, rafters, hunting guides, those who use the rivers. They looked at historical accounts existing in archives. We dug through state files. And we dug through federal files to understand the use of these rivers in the past. Through this in-depth analysis, we are convinced that this is the next best thing to actually getting your feet wet and experiencing the rivers. Because of our vast geography, because of how widely diverse our submerged lands are in this state, at this point, this is our best plan to move forward and understand exactly where our authority extends. In the first phase, as we've alluded to, the bill in front of you includes all National Park System units, as well as U.S. Forest Service units, and the Tetlin National Wildlife Refuge. If this were to pass, next year we would show up and report on all Fish and Wildlife Service refuges. The following year, all BLM lands. The fourth and final phase would be an ongoing process of refinement as our knowledge grows. If we were to engage with quiet title litigation, as previously mentioned, we would be able to say precisely where our authority extends and make it reflect the decision from the court as of that point. So we feel that the reporting requirement in this particular fourth phase is important to ensure that this list reflects reality as best as is possible. This is not a new structure. This is a structure that we have taken from the RS-2477 codification of the 1990s. This is an effort that has aided managers. It has aided individuals in understanding where state transportation rights exist and how they can utilize them, how they can best utilize them for their own purposes in the own best interest of Alaskans. And we believe that the lessons learned from that piece of legislation and that project can really benefit our issues and our efforts with submerged lands and statehood defense. In particular, we feel that codifying this list allows us to speak with a unified voice against a federal government that has proven unwilling to act and has proven to not have the desire to push this ball forward as the status quo benefits them. We feel that a strong legislative stamp of approval will add to that unified voice and be not just the administration or our DNR section calling for action, but would rather be a unified voice of Alaskans acting in the best interest of Alaskans. Next, we are going to go into what this may look like. What is on your screen is a map of the great state of Alaska. What you can see in the shaded areas, the lightly shaded areas, are federal conservation system units. You will notice the core nucleus of Katmai, the core nucleus of the McKinley National Monument, the entirety of the North Slope, Glacier Bay. These are areas that have valid pre-statehood withdrawals. They have been edited out of this map. If an individual were to look to recreate on a particular river and they were to speak to federal authorities and understand the federal manager's point of view, this is what they would see. The lines on the screen denote major rivers within the state. Blue lines are navigable rivers as it pertains to the federal government. And pink lines, they're not sure yet. After 64 years, they haven't determined if these large rivers are in fact navigable. So if this bill were to pass and they were to consult state law, this map would look a bit more like this. As you can see, all the pinks have turned blue. This is a coarse filter, as it is, of course, the statewide overview, and only pertains to major rivers within the state. But that's a vastly different outlook from where we stand today and where we hope to stand at the end of this legislative session. Next, we're going to travel to the Northwest Arctic. We're going to head to the Noatak National Preserve in Kobuk Valley National Park. If you were to look at the federal land manager's point of view, you would be led to believe that the main stem Kobuk, in the lower portion there, and the main stem Noatak up into the confluence with the Aniuk are the only navigable waters in these particular parks. Last summer, I had the joy of spending about 19 days on the upper Noatak, and our final takeout point was right at the confluence where that blue line ends and the hashed blue and red line begins, the confluence with the Aniuk. I can tell you that where the navigability ends as it pertains to the federal perspective, where the federal government says that that river is no longer navigable, the hydrologic measurement that we took was 3,080 CFS. That is cubic feet per second. That is 3,080 basketballs floating by you every second. We, in fact, had to come up with a novel way to take that measurement because it was a wider river than we had measured previously using our ADCP, our current profiler. So we had to come up with novel ways to span the 320 feet that is the width of that water column. Looking at the standards that exist for navigability, you best believe that floating a canoe or floating a raft on that particular portion of the river was not unduly burdensome. So if this piece of legislation were to pass, it would look a bit more like this. So what we can see in this particular instance is we have been able to take a finer grained look. We've been able to spend a lot of time in each watershed on each stream. And five individuals over 2 years have created an interactive map that's available for the public as an education tool. What you will notice is there are still undetermined rivers on here. There's still an acknowledgement that we have not set foot in the headwater streams of the Aniuk. There are still questions, but these, in our mind, are reasonable questions that we're willing to settle for, that we're willing to say we may know one day where the extent of navigability lies. But up until that point, here is our conservative estimate. Here, John Q. Public, is where state law applies. And here is where Alaska authority extends. So I will pass it back to my colleague, Jim Walker, but be happy to entertain any questions if they exist.
Well, I just want to say to all the boys and girls listening, if you ever wanted to be Lewis and Clark, there's still the opportunity to explore and identify what is indeed navigable.
Chair Vance, we are hiring. So.
That's my pitch right there.
Yeah.
Be the next Lewis and Clark. Questions from the committee members. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I understand what we could do with the navigable water. I'm curious about the submerged land. What value is it to the state to have ownership of the submerged land?
Through the chair, Representative Gray. The ownership of the submerged land, as it relates to the case, the John Sturgeon case that we discussed earlier with John Sturgeon on the line, the ownership of that land dictates the ability for managers to dictate uses above that land. When I say uses, I mean the ability to enjoy that land. So state law can dictate what kind of boats are able to be used. It could dictate whether generators are appropriate in those particular instances. Further, if somebody were to build a dock, they would have to apply it to the state for that permit. Whereas the federal uplands, in the case of this bill, would be owned by the uplands would be owned by the federal government. If we had not owned the submerged lands, that would be a federal permit. So the ownership of the submerged lands, if you can think of it as your backyard, and if somebody would want to build a zip line over it, you would have say into whether that zip line could be established. And so you would have say in that.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up. So if you wanted to build a dock, I assume that your dock would have to go onto the land, would not just the submerged part. Mm-hmm. So if the land surrounding the navigable water is federal, would you have to apply to both?
Through the chair, Representative Gray. It would depend on the exact nature of the dock. In some instances, yes, if you were going to have pilings on the uplands as well as the submerged lands, you would have to apply to both. And those management decisions would be something that we would have to have conversations with our federal counterparts about. We would hope that those conversations would be neighborly, that we would be able to speak sovereign to sovereign and reach an agreement about what is in the best interest in this particular watershed and what is in the best interest in this particular environment. What this bill seeks to do, however, is to ensure that we have those conversations and ensure that our seat at the table is reserved for us and is not necessarily given away or overlooked because of another entity's preferences.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Eller.
Thank you. And through the chair. So a couple of questions, if I may. What other states are so inundated by the federal government that they have this exact type of issue? Number one, if we've compared it to any other state. And number two, we ask, what is the benefit for Alaska to have these navigable waters? So, I mean, let's get dirty. What is the benefit to the federal government having these navigable waters taken from Alaskans? Besides, I'm sure you're going to say fiscal, but let's get a little deeper if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard. Alaskans have owned these lands since the day of statehood. The benefit to Alaskans is the ability to control our own resources and the use of those resources. Other states have not had the experience that we have had. That's a product partially of the fact that we are a younger state. As my colleague Jim will speak to, our standard of navigability, how we determine navigability, is through the boat that was in existence at the time of statehood. For East Coast states, you can imagine that is going to be a dramatically different boat than one that was in existence on January 3rd, 1959. So the boat that we are using is a rubber raft, is a canoe, is a John boat, is a jet boat to determine this navigability. Because of that wider standard, because of the vast landscape that we're applying that more permissive standard to, our problems are more complicated. And frankly, our submerged lands are attractive. They are vast in number, and they are our road systems. They are our transportation corridors. So in these instances, I believe that we face stronger opposition, partially because the quality and the quantity of the resources at hand.
Thank you. And can I just do a follow-up
comment?
Yeah, I'm so impressed with you guys being here today because – and I'm going to tread lightly. There's a few people within, I believe, our departments, John Skidmore being one, that are so passionate about looking out for Alaskans that I absolutely just appreciate you guys being here. Your heart's in it. You're Alaskans. And everything you're bringing forward is just spot on. And your commitment to our state is noted. So thank you so much.
Any further questions before we continue?
Through the chair, for the record, Jim Walker with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources again. I'll move through these remaining slides quickly as we have discussed the gravamen of them already. But one of the things that the bill does, in addition to the list, is that it enshrines foundational elements of relevant case law to guide in our navigability determinations. We have had a robust history of litigation on these navigability issues with the federal government. There is a robust history of navigability litigation from the lower 48. And all of that case law provides the guide and provides the standards by which we have undertaken our navigability determinations and which we have included as standards within this particular legislation. For example, as my colleague Danny Hovancic mentioned, through case law, we know that you make navigability determinations based upon the date of statehood and what type of watercraft were in use there. I am originally from the state of Tennessee. It became a state in 1796. The types of boats that were in use at the date of statehood then versus 1959 are dramatically different. And so the cases, particularly our Gulcana River case, sets forth a long list of much smaller, lighter watercraft that only have a certain displacement, and they identify those as crafts that can be used for purposes of determining navigability. This is laid out in the statute. Similarly, concepts of susceptibility. The law says that the river, in order to be navigable, in fact, must have been used as a highway of trade, travel, or commerce at the date of statehood. Or is the important word, it was susceptible of such use. That recognizes that places like Alaska, we don't necessarily have a robust historical record, right? There may not be a lot of historical accounts in a library's archive somewhere of someone floating down this river and trapping or doing whatever they did. As a result, the law recognizing that allows us through modern day usage, if the river is in its natural and ordinary condition, if we can float it now in a criterion craft, it is presumed to have been navigable at the date of statehood. The legislation incorporates those susceptibility standards. And then other principles that we see from time to time. For example, two-way traffic is not required to establish navigability. The river doesn't have to be easy, right? Portages are okay as long as they are not unreasonable. These various principles are also all incorporated in the statute. Again, the statute defines the geographic scope, and we're talking about federally owned lands statewide. It also defines, similarly, key concepts, ordinary high water mark, navigability, submerged lands, federal areas, etc. And if I might go back to a question that Representative Gray asked about building of the dock, by identifying the navigability of the river, that's the first question. Then the question becomes, to what extent does the state own the lands? And the law says that we own, in the case of a navigable, in fact, river, to the ordinary high water mark on the left bank and the right bank. So to the extent that the dock can be built below the ordinary high water mark, no federal action is required. If you are going to build and have some type of structure up on the uplands to connect, you're going to need to follow federal law because you're in a federal area. So these types of key concepts are also identified in the statute. Again, we've talked about the annual reporting requirement. I will not do so further here, but it will keep fresh everything in this list because we are profoundly aware that the public relies upon this. And we want it to be accurate because we do not want anyone to get into harm's way, to potentially put themselves in legal jeopardy, relying upon something that we are not prepared to stand up for in the courtroom. In closing, as we have said, our ownership of submerged lands beneath navigable, in fact, entirely influenced rivers, is one of the fundamental promises of statehood. After 63 years, It is time that that promise be kept. And we believe and are overjoyed to support House Bill 98 as a bold step in that direction.
Thank you for your presentation. You. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not quite understanding what you're saying with reference to canoes. Maybe you could be a little bit more clear. So certainly back during the French and Indian Wars, there was commerce being engaged with Indians and canoes in the colonies before the Constitution. Why is canoe something that we're talking about as well as kind of new? How are canoes different from canoes that were used a long time ago?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can't answer the question as to what my counterparts in Tennessee or Georgia or South Carolina were thinking when they pursued the navigability litigation. Maybe they should have asserted canoes as a traditional watercraft. The Supreme Court's decisions, the Circuit Courts of Appeals decisions, all support the use of canoes. All I can speak for is here in Alaska, we have a real strong tradition of folks using those for various occupations, various endeavors in 1959. So we use them today to prove navigability as well.
Thank you. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
To the chair. So as the state and the federal government have kind of battling definitions of navigable water, what implications, if any, would the fact that we prevail impact some number of other states?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, to the extent that we prevail, I submit that all the boats rise together, not to use too much of a pun there. But if we prevail on issues here, it benefits the state governments of particularly our sister western states. I know that my unit is coordinated with, oftentimes by similar groups within, the state of South Dakota and other states that are grappling on a smaller scale with many of the issues here. So, everything that we establish here would benefit litigation in the lower 48 with the understanding that you have to look through the prism of the date of statehood, right? So Montana became a state much earlier than us. South Dakota much earlier than us. That's the key date for those states in determining what they're entitled to under the equal footing doctrine. But with that caution, with that qualification, any cases that we decide and have judgments in our favor will benefit state governments all across the United States.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Through the chair again. So on the map you put out earlier, I noticed some of the waterways are adjacent to or crossing international boundaries. To what extent is the definition of navigable water in those instances impact any treaties or other things that would concern the federal government?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, at the boundary with Canada, for example, there is a federal withdrawal for that boundary, right, which would include the submerged lands on that narrow fringe. So that would be excluded as it is right up against the boundary. Other than that, the fact that the river flows to Canada, from Canada through Alaska, and there may be a history of trade between Canada and the United States or Alaska, historically, that type of evidence of that commerce back and forth only strengthens our claim.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Philip.
So
on Section 9 particularly, the list you have, the 83-page list, you had mentioned in your presentation that you didn't want to unwittingly tell the public to go travel on a waterway that they might get hemmed up with the feds for traveling.
I'm not quite sure I understand the logic of that, though, because obviously John Surgeon's case comes to mind. It wasn't as though, when you talk about the federal default of indeterminate, it wasn't as though he went and did what he did and the National Park Service said, wait, it's indeterminate. They seem to have a very strong opinion about the fact that he couldn't travel there, and the court case, obviously came out of that. Likewise, how is it that we have put that list together, unless you're saying that everything on there we don't think the federal government is going to challenge, in which case, all right, now we've made it so that we are not encouraging another situation like what happened to John. But is that it? I mean, how else did this list come together if there's more to it than that?
Through the chair, Representative Beesman, first, a word about John Sturgeon's case. The Nation River had already been determined to be navigable through litigation, right? Because there was that navigability assessment by a federal district court is one of the reasons which John prevailed in his litigation. What we are attempting to do with this legislation is also step into that breach where there is confusion about who owns the submerged lands. By this legislature firmly declaring we own these submerged lands, we think that we would benefit anyone who finds himself in John Sturgeon's case down the road in a better legal position. Similarly, because we are affirmatively, through this statute, planting the state flag in the submerged lands, should someone be threatened with prosecution or actually prosecuted, my hope is that because of this strong declaration from the state, we could stand arm in arm with that individual and say, not so fast. That is state property. We own it. Your laws do not trump our ownership of it.
Follow up. And so of the lands that the state may or does have title to that aren't on the list, why else were they not included on the list?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, again, this concerns federal areas, right? So the boundaries of the purview of this litigation are well set. It's going to be a federal area that is subject to this list. So areas, for example, that are state-owned, if they're state-owned, I don't think we're going to have any problem about, saying whether they're navigable or not. We decide, through the unit, we make the determinations, those will be taken care of. On other private lands, we haven't done the navigability determinations and included them in those bills because, as you know, in Alaska, privately owned lands account for a small percentage of all the lands. And this bill, with 83 pages, of the tranche one of the list is pretty ambitious already. If we were to include everything from sea to Canadian border, from north to south, this list would be exponentially longer. And it seemed to us that this was a good way of making things plain in areas where we have had an ongoing controversy with the federal government over who owns what.
Final follow-up? And can you just tell us, the list that we have here before us in this bill, does the state currently, is it state policy to manage those lands, those navigable waterways, for example? I know here in Juneau, some of the water here adjacent to the Capitol has been the subject of mining claims. If someone were to file a mining claim for some portion of one of these waterways, is the state going to act upon that as though it is state land, or or because there's some question, is the state going to hold off on making, you know, those management decisions?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if it's state land, any type of application that would be made would be adjudicated on its merits on a case-by-case basis. And I think that, you know, consistent with our constitutional mandate, which is, you know, to maximize resource development consistent with the public good, those decisions would be made. I can't really address a hypothetical question about whether we're going to have a mining claim here or here or here, but I can assure you that they would be adjudicated with, you know, a fair consideration of the best uses involved.
Thank you.
I'd like to let the members know that we've included the Department of Law's Federal Lands and Litigation Report of 2023 for reference, that gives some insight in some of the ongoing litigation for your reference. And before we continue with questions for the two before us, we still have Mr. Sturgeon available online to speak to his specific situation, if that would be helpful to members. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not necessarily to Mr. Sturgeon. I recall back to a day when we were trying to settle some of the historic trails, and we'd claim them, and the federal government said, well, there's just not enough research. You know, you haven't mapped them, you haven't surveyed them. How confident are you in the assessment of water that we've assessed everything and we are within the purview of the federal government not saying, well, no, you just haven't done enough? Some places they wanted pictures of wagons going over old trails or sleds, so they wanted that kind of stuff. You had to go way back into the archives. So, and we were denied a lot just because, well, we just didn't have that much. So how confident are you in the assessments of these actual lands that they are navigable? Does it actually take a boat to go there? What, can you fill me in a little bit of that and the differences?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we like to say within our team that a river speaks for itself. If it is in its natural and ordinary condition, the river speaks for itself. A trail, by contrast, being man-made in Alaska with our growing seasons and whatnot, needs our help, right? We have to speak for the trail. With these rivers that we're looking at, if it's in its natural and ordinary condition, and everything on the list is, we are highly, highly confident that everything on that list is navigable, in fact, or tidally influenced. And if we had to engage in litigation, we would win. With regards to trails, with trails, you have to show, you know, that they were, if in the case of RS-2477s, that the land grant was accepted within a period of acceptance by either public use or governmental action. And in so doing, it requires a very, very deep dive into history. We have to marshal all of those historical records to prove the existence, the validity of an RS-2477. We don't have that with rivers. With rivers, if we can float them today in a criterion craft, something that is meaningfully similar to the type of watercraft that was in use at the date of statehood, if we can float it now and it's in its natural and ordinary condition, it is navigable pursuant to federal law.
Follow up.
Thank you. Little change of subject. I was dip netting on the Copper River, and a guy came up to me with a picture of a boat going up this stream, jet boat, big one, and wanted me to, as a legislator, say, this is navigable water. It was basically a waterfall, but he had a boat on it, and he launched his boat at the top of it, floated down or powered down and powered back up. Where does that kind of fit into it? I mean, that clearly navigable, there's a boat on it. So, you know, and it's a stream that's probably here to the street out there, but it, you know how the Copper River is. And he wanted that to be a navigable water so that he could basically formulate a boat launch.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. Navigability does not have to be without hardship. Portages are allowed. A famous historical case of this is in Great Falls, Montana, and Lewis and Clark's navigation around those Great Falls, if you will. So in that instance, while his photo of him operating the boat on that particular portion of the river might not have been the smoking gun, he may not have been wrong. So it depends. It depends on a river by river basis. But as long as that river is in its natural and ordinary condition, it's something that the state would have to assess, but may be comfortable asserting is in fact navigable.
Follow up. Where do native lands fall in the terms of federal ownership, or however is that determined? Because this was definitely a stream that went up, split native lands to a public land, and so he asserted his right to travel that and to build a boat launch was legitimate. So where's native land fall into this that's claimed and you know, documented and everything? Where would native lands fall into this navigability issue?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, Jim Walker, Alaska Department of Natural Resources, for the record. The purview of this bill, first of all, only considers federal areas. Native corporation lands are private property, right? So they are beyond the purview of this bill. To your scenario where the gentleman took a stream off of the Copper River and went upstream over very, very challenging conditions, it sounds like, I can assure you that none of those are included in this list that is in the bill. Nothing that type of aggressively argued as navigable, right? That being said, determining whether or not that particular stream is navigable is done on a case-by-case basis. If there is a waterfall, the question then becomes, is it something that you can easily portage, right? You can go around. Or is it something that is going to create an unreasonable obstacle? Right. So we would look at all of these things on a case by case basis in making that determination. Now, just because a particular river is located on Native Corporation lands doesn't mean the state doesn't own the submerged land. Right. So for large rivers all across the state, very large rivers that go through Native Corporation lands, and that's not part of this bill, but in those areas, the state owns those submerged lands. And we are always working with the Native corporations to try to see if we can, you know, achieve understanding and achieve agreements as to use and management of those particular waterways.
I know I have more questions, but I just don't know exactly what they are at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Carpenter.
Madam Chair, I have a question about the Section 12 retroactivity clause. It says Section 9 of this act is retroactive to January 3rd, 1959. I'm curious if we've got somebody from law that might be able to talk to us about whether an assessment's been conducted on the consequences of retroactivity. Just curious.
Mr. Opsahl, are you available to answer the question?
I'm on the line, yes, but I did not hear the question.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will repeat the question. I am wanting to know specifically, has an assessment been conducted on the consequences of the retroactivity clause?
Thank you, Representative Carpenter, through the chair. Ron Opsahl, Department of Law. I would have to check in on that. I'm sure we have. I just don't know what that outcome was.
Follow up.
Okay. Then I guess to the chair, I would like to see what the legal opinion is on the retroactivity. I'm just curious, since 1959, if anything if there are any private citizens or others that have had court cases or other issues arise that were adjudicated in a particular way that would then be potentially adjudicated a different way now that it's retroactive. I don't know.
Great question, Representative. Do you have insight, Mr. Walker?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, we'll be happy to provide that answer in writing. You know, I think it is important to remember that we're just talking about federal areas within this legislation, and the retroactivity going back to the date of statehood only applies to those federal areas. And so it is the intent of the legislation to say we are not getting any new conveyance. We're just getting what we got in 1959 when we became a state. But I would be happy to provide any type of written answer to you on the retroactivity question.
I guess a follow-up would be just to point out that there might be other John Sturgeons out there that had issues, and I'm just unaware of them. So I'm just curious if there's an implication here for others. Thank you.
I do have another question for Department of Law. Just for the record, one of the changes in the bill is including the word on the date instead of at the time the state achieved statehood. So, Mr. Opsahl, if you could give the reasons why that wording was needed.
Thank you, through the chair, Ron Opsahl, for the record. I believe at the time would reference a time on the clock. And on the date represents a date on the calendar. That's the best answer I can give for that.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Follow up through the chair. So I had the same question. And it just occurs to me that seems like a not very substantive reason to change the definition of something in statute. Surely there's a greater argument than that. Is it uniformity with some other statute or something? I'm still a little bit curious as to why we're repealing that entire definition, replacing it for the change of those very few words.
Through the chair, let me follow up with our legislative section and see what they have to say on that.
Thank you. That would be appreciated. Representative Gray.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, since so many of our rivers are frozen, some of them most of the year, because we walk on our rivers, ski on our rivers, snow machine on our rivers, drive on our rivers, is there a value to the use of our rivers when they're frozen by having them be state water instead of federal water?
Through the chair, Representative Gray. The determination of title ownership must be made when the water is in its liquid state. That's what the law says. You consider the water within its liquid state. That being said, when we own the submerged lands, and the water freezes and we use it for other things besides boating, for example, absolutely there is a benefit to the state being the owner of those submerged lands, because one of the incidents of that ownership is the ability to say how that water can be used, right? And when I say use, I'm not talking about consumptive uses. I'm talking about boating and walking on the ice or, you know, operating a vehicle on the ice, a snow machine, whatever. So yes, absolutely. It benefits our winter pursuits on the navigable rivers, even though their navigability can only be determined when they are in their liquid state.
Follow up.
So that gives rise to the question of, let's say that we determine that it's only navigable to this section when it's liquid, but when it's frozen, you can keep driving. I mean, maybe it's a hypothetical. I don't know if it comes up. Does it come up where the federal government says you can't drive there?
Sure. For the record, Daniel Hovancic, DNR. In this particular instance, for rivers that are in their frozen condition, there is a court case, I believe it's Slop Bucket Lake, that prohibits us to determining navigability in its frozen condition. So it has to be in its liquid state at the time. That being said, rivers are often used, as you know, as corridors of travel. So I don't know of any particular instance in which that line has become troublesome in the winter rather than in the summer, but I also defer to Jim if he has further perspectives.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, you know, is this a problem? Is this just something that we're aware of being a problem? And the answer is, I'm not aware of it being a problem. However, I see your point. If we say it's navigable to a certain point and someone continues their usage up above that, I would suggest that in federal areas, one of the educational aspects of this list is don't do that. Unless you want to run afoul of federal authorities. You know, what we're hoping and what we're saying with this list is up to this point, we are very confident. Beyond this, if we have to sue and we litigate with the federal government, you better believe we're going to claim it as far upstream as we can. But because this is a public-facing document, we don't want someone to unwittingly become the next John Sturgeon. So my advice to them would be, if you want to use it above that, you better check with federal land managers as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Sturgeon, if you're still available, would you be able to speak to your personal experience of why you believe it would be better to interface with the state of Alaska regarding navigable waters versus the federal government?
Yes, Madam Chair. I've got a great example. The law that the federal government, the National Park Service, that I violated, there was one sentence in this big book of regulations, and that one sentence said that hovercrafts are not allowed in parks and preserves. And I researched where that came from. That came from a person in Washington, D.C. that wanted to use a hovercraft as a taxi. And since the National Park Service manages the general public land in Washington, D.C. area, the parks, monuments, et cetera, they passed a regulation from Washington, D.C. that inadvertently affected all of Alaska, all the national parks and preserves in Alaska. And that is the regulation that they contended that I violated. So it's one of those unintended consequences things. The federal government often doesn't look at Alaska. The laws aren't specific to Alaska, and we just got caught up in a general regulation they applied nationwide that really did affect Alaska, because more of my hovercraft runs on the Yukon River. If I could, Madam Chair, there were two questions that people, one other question person asked, if I could answer that.
Yes, please do.
There was a question about why the submerged lands are important. Well, if you're a hunter on the Yukon River, the Kuskokwim, the Susitna, any large river, they have huge gravel bars, and a person could very easily just hunt the gravel bars in those huge rivers, even if the upland is owned by the federal government. In fact, at 77 years old, when I hunt moose these days, I pull up to a gravel bar and I start calling and I wait for a moose to come to me, and it's normally on a gravel bar. So that's where the submerged lands, it doesn't have to be covered by water, just so it's below ordinary high water. So I hope that answered your questions, Madam Chair. Any other questions, be glad to try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, I assume when we're talking about whether or not the state owns title to this land and is going to be able to manage uses, that we're not just talking about travel and transportation. We're also talking about managing of harvesting of resources, fishing and whatnot. Is that what we're talking about here as well? Because we haven't mentioned that specifically.
For the record, Daniel Hovancic, through the chair, Representative Eastman. The management of fishing in particular is not impacted by this bill. The Sturgeon decision specifically carves out the Katie John trilogy as not impacting that particular instance. The harvesting of resources, feasibly, if it's something that falls within state law, they could apply for a permit with the state, and it would be adjudicated on a permit-by-permit basis. That being said, they would have to have their entire operation on the submerged lands, which is not always a feasible prospect. If you can imagine, you know, by definition, they will flood. They are dynamic environments and dynamic landscapes. So there's it is instance by instance in that regard, but fishing is, and the harvesting of fish would not be involved.
And can you just help us understand, you know, why it's not involved? It's not involved because there's no current conflict between the way the federal, government has allocated or allowed the state to do the management, et cetera, or is it for some other reason?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. In particular, if it is an inland fish, if it is a freshwater fish, then those creatures are held in trust by the state for the general public, just as, you know, the ungulates like moose or deer, anything of that sort. So the state would already be regulating the freshwater fish. If it is a saltwater species, an anadromous species that spends time in the oceans, then that would be a federal regulation, I believe.
Follow up. And I understand that to be the case. What I'm trying to dig into is, how did that come to be the case? Is that because there's a federal law or policy somewhere that says, you know, we're not going to contest the state management of these fish, whether or not the river is navigable or not, whether or not it's, you know, goes into or out of a national park or not? You know, how is it that we can say that, you know, confidently the state is managing that, and the federal government isn't going to come in at some future time and say, you thought it was navigable, we decided it's not. You thought you could fish there, we decided you can't.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am no expert on fish and game law. I would truthfully have to defer to my colleagues within that department. My colleague Danny Hovancic indicated some of what we understand and know to be the case in terms of our involvement as land and waters manager. I really have to say I do not understand or know the answer to your question about what is the genesis of the different regulatory screens for this species or that species of fish.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if the question of ownership is in limbo right now between jurisdictions, and this is going to be a way to solve that, and it moves to a state ownership concept, which I'm in favor of. Does that also mean that access and regulation and taxation becomes something that the state is able to do with those waters that it currently isn't able to do?
Through the chair, the clarity that this legislation brings would help all of those questions that you raise. In terms of taxation, I don't know if I would say specifically taxation, but rather I would say that if an operator wished to do something on the submerged lands or the water flowing over them that required a state permit, and that permit had cost associated with it, those dollars should be paid to the state of Alaska and not the federal government. So hopefully there will be a shifting of some of those funds that are presently enriching federal coffers to enrich state coffers. So I think that there would be some of that that would follow this. I don't think that taxation is going to be a specific issue. Because all of these submerged lands would be owned by the state of Alaska. In terms of permitting and other activities, absolutely. It provides a bright line at the ordinary high water mark in the case of a navigable impact water, or at the line of mean high tide in the case of a tidally influenced water, where state property begins and ends. So it provides a bright boundary line so that the public and others will understand whose law I need to follow, if I need a permit from the state, you know, who should I go to, what the cost would be associated with that. I hope that's responsive.
I think so. Thank you, Madam Chair. I used the wrong term. Taxation is not exactly what I was mm-hmm. looking at. It's not moving. We can't tax it. It's land. Mm-hmm. It's state-owned land. I guess what I was getting at is regulation and fee structure. Mm-hmm. If there's a state park and there's a parking lot and I have access to that state park, there's usually a user box, a fee box associated with it. Mm-hmm. Currently, there might be access points to rivers that have ambiguous ownership, mm-hmm. and the state creates ownership through this bill. Then a user fee box pops up and whoever's accessing now owes a fee because the state owns it. That's in my mind. Are we creating that opportunity in the future because it is state owned?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes. I mean, that would be a matter that I'm sure this legislature would take up at the appropriate time down the road. But the ability to charge fees for use of state property is certainly within the province of this body.
Just to be clear, that's not part of a long-term fiscal plan that I'm considering.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So since this bill is retroactive to 1959, is there anything that the state has done, or for that matter, not done, that would be construed or could be construed as estoppel in terms of asserting these rights? Is there, you know, when the federal government has come in and said this is ours, has the state backed off and said, well, we're not going to challenge you on this particular river or this particular management decision and so forth, and then the federal government or someone could come in and say, well, you know, it's nice for you to say this goes back to 1959, but you haven't been entirely consistent since 1959 over asserting these rights and actually managing them. And you know, for example, the example I gave earlier of someone filing a mining claim, there are some of these waterways where someone has sought to use it and the state has said, well, you know, we're not going to act on that right now because it's, you know, up in doubt or in other words, we're not acting as though it's ours to manage.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if there was some decision that was decided against the state of Alaska for any of the waters involved in this legislation, it wouldn't be in the legislation. Further, if there is a pre-statehood withdrawal involved, it's not in the legislation. Beyond that, in terms of any management decision that the state may have made that would seem at cross purposes with this legislation, I'm not aware of it.
Representative Gray.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, when you talk about the normal high water mark or the average high water mark, I immediately started thinking about like, well, an ice jam could create a very high water mark. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a lot of snow in South Central this particular winter. We could have some pretty high water marks this spring. How do you decide what the normal high water mark is?
For the record, Daniel Hovancic. Through the chair, Representative Gray, I actually have the definition written down in front of me. And that is the line on the shore established by fluctuations of water, leaving an impression on the bank, the evidence for which could be a clear natural line impressed on the bank, shelving on the bank, change in soil characteristics, destruction of terrestrial vegetation, or presence of litter and debris. This is for ordinary high water mark. That is the standard that would be applied to a riparian system, to a river system. If it is tidally influenced, the standard switches and becomes a mean high tide, which would be the average of the high tides. So it would be depending on what system you're using and depending on if it would be tidally influenced.
For the record, Jim Walker as well, through the chair, Representative Gray, practically speaking, when you talk about ice jams and whatnot, that's not ordinary, right? That's an exceptional event. So where it denotes that on the bank, that's not the ordinary high water mark. The ordinary high water mark is something that is established year after year after year through continual flowing of the water. So think of the willow line on the bank of a river. Think of the scar that you see on the bank of the river. That is the boundary that denotes where state ownership ends.
Thanks. Any further questions from committee members? All right. Thank you so much for the presentation. Representative Sadler, would you like to make any further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. I would. For the record, this is Representative Dan Sadler, sponsor of HB 98. I just want to express to the committee members and to the chairman my appreciation for this respectful and thorough vetting of this bill. You've gotten good questions, and I trust you've gotten good answers. The issue of navigable waters and submerged lands is one that I've had the privilege to be involved in a couple different hats over my career, and so I'm tremendously pleased to be able to be in a position to bring this before the legislature for, I hope, resolution. I see this bill as an opportunity to respectfully but vigorously push the federal government to resolution and clarify some important aspects of our state sovereignty and our statehood rights. It is, in the poetic sense, it's the next step in Alaska's long journey toward assuming our rightful status as a full-fledged state, along with our sister states, on equal footing. One thing I noted in the questions that came up is, in looking at the list, we tend to focus on the first couple pages and the last couple pages. There are 83 pages of lists of names. The vast majority of those are unnamed waterway, unnamed river, unnamed bank, A significant portion are Alaskan native names, the Kulik River. I couldn't pronounce a lot of them. And some, but not very many, are what I'll call, white guy names. Mosquito Fork, Good Hope River, Sandblast River, Bear Lake, Sheep Creek. This list will probably evolve and grow as DNR continues to make its assertions on navigability. And as the list evolves, I think there will be the opportunity for more people to bring Alaskan native names to these water bodies. As we evolve towards acknowledging our native heritage and our naming our natural resources and natural features. And I would like to think that perhaps this list would provide an impetus and inspiration for opportunities to have those kind of names happen. So I actually have lived through the RS-247 Seven Wars. It's a real treat to have Senator Representative Ogun here to watch this. I think this is an important assertion of Alaska's sovereignty, and I appreciate your hearing. I'll be glad to answer any questions off the record, on the record, and look forward to the committee's decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Any questions for the sponsor of the bill? Wonderful presentation. I would like to note that I am going to set an amendment deadline for tomorrow, March 30th. That's Thursday at 5 p.m. If you could get your amendments, we're trying to raise the budget that I intend upon the favor with legal to be able to take up House Bill 68, but also take up this bill on Friday. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Friday, March 31st at 1 p.m. to bring back House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking by the Governor as presented by the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law to hopefully consider the committee substitute. We are waiting with great anticipation, and then bring up House Bill 98 once again. Thank you to our invited testifiers, to Mr. Sturgeon, Mr. Opsahl from Department of Law, who is online. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 2:48 p.m.